Much lower than that. A preponderance of the evidence is just like if you've got an equal scale, dropping a feather on that scale and it tilting the scale ever so slightly. It's hard to quantify it, but it would probably be something close to a 51-49 ratio. And it's up to a judge, not a jury, to decide whether or not this defendant is immune. And if a judge hears the evidence and says, I find by a preponderance that this defendant was justified and was standing his ground under Alabama law, then that man or woman is immune criminally and civilly. He can't be sued for it either.
Yes. So in that situation, because I'm going to ask us a question here, in that situation, he would be immune, the case would be dismissed, and the state would have, I guess, what, 42 days to appeal it. If they don't, it is a final ruling. Is that correct?
Yes. The state could appeal a finding of stand-your-ground immunity. I don't know that they have. I haven't read any cases where the state did such an appeal, but they have the right to do that, yes.
So here's the question. I wonder if a defendant has the same right. Probably not, but I wonder if they do. If a judge ruled, if I presented a case and the judge ruled against me, I wonder if, and I'm sure the issue's been in front of the court. I don't know. I don't know if anybody's ever taken that up.
Well, I researched that. I had two cases this year where I asserted stand your ground immunity. And in both of those cases, my stand your ground request for my clients was denied.
By the court.
And so we went forward, and in both cases, the jury heard the evidence and found the clients not guilty. In one case, they were hung and mistried on one lower count. So just because a judge finds you don't have stand your ground immunity, the defendant can still go to trial and say, I was defending myself. Yes. And that just takes us back to common law self-defense, yes, like we had before this new law.
And that issue, the finding of the judge, of course, would not become part of the evidence. You know what I'm saying? The state couldn't bring it up. Hey, judge, you've already heard this in front of a jury. You've already heard this and determined that this ain't gonna fly.
They could not do that. That would be inadmissible. The jury would never hear it. However, let's say the man or woman on trial testifies at the stand your ground hearing and says, hey, I reasonably believe this person was about to hurt me or shoot me or whatever. And they talk about what happened in the encounter. Say the case goes on to trial, stand your ground, gets denied, then those statements can be introduced against that defendant at his trial from his stand your ground hearing.
So the statements can be introduced by the state?
Yes.
In their case?
Yes.
Oof.
Yes.
That's why it's important, and I'm sure I know Champ does, because Champ's a good lawyer. We always instruct our clients to answer the question and answer the question only, because sometimes if you talk about stuff that's really not relevant in your case, you kind of get out on tangents and say stuff, and then when that's brought back up in front of you, especially in front of a jury, it's hard to remember that stuff that you talked about that's really not relevant. And then make a liar out of you, like, real fast.
Well, sure. In any criminal case, as you said earlier, Melvin, that defendant has got the right not to speak.
Yes.
But if he does speak at, say, a pretrial stand-your-ground hearing, then that testimony can be introduced against him at his trial. So it's, yes, something that you have to be very careful with.
Yes. And keep it limited.
Yes.
To them issues. That's interesting. So let's talk a little bit about the stand your ground. I didn't realize that prior they had an issue about the prior law. You could defend property. This is kind of crazy. You can use physical force. It's always been like that, and it's still like this, on another person if you want to prevent or terminate a commission of a criminal trespass. The law also provides that you can use, that's just using regular physical force, what you believe necessary to stop it. But deadly physical force can be used defending property if you're defending someone else. I don't know why they say that. Or arson in the first or second degree by the trespasser. So you can, according to the old law, and I believe it is in the new statute, mm-hmm. that you can use deadly physical force to prevent the commission of arson in the first or second degree by the trespasser. So if someone's burning your house,
yes,
or burning your barns or whatever else, I wouldn't suggest it, but you could use deadly physical force. You may just want to use your physical force.
Yeah, and in any self-defense, the amount of force has to be reasonable under the circumstances.
Yes.
And for certain types of crimes, the legislature said this type of force is admissible. Now, you know, if someone, say, does not have a weapon and they push somebody or insult someone or use some other type, you know, some sort of harassment, deadly physical force is not going to be reasonable under those circumstances. There has to be a serious threat in order for deadly physical force to be used, and the legislature talks about, you know, kidnapping, burglary, robbery, other types of crimes by forcible compulsion.
Something interesting in the new statute, and it may have been in the old one, I don't know, but there is it talks about, and this is very important, danger to innocent persons. And what that statute says, even if you're justified or excused in using force against a person, but you recklessly or negligently injure or create a substantial injury to another person, then the justifications afforded by this article are unavailable in a prosecution for such recklessness or negligence. So I was trying to think of a situation. If you were at your house, let's just say someone was in your yard, you thought they were stealing your property or they was going to harm you and doing it, and you just brought out an AK-47 and started shooting like crazy, and you accidentally shot your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
According to the statute, from what I read it, you would not be able to argue, hey, I was standing my ground and I messed up.
You would not. You would not have stand your ground protection criminally or civilly.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyone who does that, you can bet, is going to be sued as well as yes. prosecuted. And that's just something, not to digress, a criminal prosecution and a civil prosecution are not mutually exclusive.
Yes.
You know, when there is, and I think that's why the legislature in this stand your ground law had it apply to both, that if you're justified defending yourself, standing your ground in a criminal case, then that flows downhill to the civil lawsuit as well.
And the something new with the law that we had discussed prior to the show, Champ, is the fact that it almost puts somewhat of a burden on law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, as far as someone asserting they stand your ground. And can you kind of describe that a little bit?
Yes. In December of 2015, when the legislature amended the Stand Your Ground law, they said the law enforcement agency may not arrest the person for using force unless it determines that there is probable cause that the force used was unlawful. So someone is being arrested for assault or shooting someone or whatever, and they said they were defending themselves. Then under Alabama law, there is a burden on that law enforcement agency to say by probable cause the force this person used was unlawful before they arrested.
So they can't just arrest. Technically, they can't just arrest someone and say, well, we'll shake this out when we go to trial or whatever else. They almost have a burden to look, make a decision, not start arresting everyone there and make a decision, hey, is there something out here that shows that these actions was unlawful, this person was acting unlawful, and they should have never that they just don't have a standing ground defense is what they're going to essentially.
And they can use standard procedures for investigating the use of force. But, yeah, there seems to be an extra requirement here as far as determining, hey, there was probable cause that the force was unlawful.
I would assume if I was a prosecutor that maybe the best way to handle these type of cases when there looks like there is a situation where someone may have a stand your ground defense, that would be a prime time to not arrest someone, take his case to a grand jury after it's investigated, and let a grand jury determine. You know what I'm saying? If they're going to, before you just start charging someone with assault or murder or whatever else, that maybe you would have, 12 other people in a grand jury, or 18 if you get 18. The whole 18 there to decide, hey, I'm going to no-bill this, or I am going to issue an indictment, you know. And that would be probably a good way to get around it. I don't know that that's the best way, but.
Yeah, because there's two different ways of arresting, either on a warrant or through a grand jury process.
All right, Champ, I think we have a phone call. Is it Ted from Vinemont?
All right.
Hey, Ted, are you there?
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm here.
You have a question for us?
Oh, yes, I do. Attorney Crawford, this is Ted from Vinemont.
Hello, Ted.
I've enjoyed this Stand Your Ground presentation, but I've got a little bit of a more personal question.
Okay.
I'd like to ask you, if you don't mind, how many guns do you own?
How many guns do I own?
Yes.
Enough.
Okay.
I'm not going to tell you how many, Ted, but I own enough.
Okay. Well, thank you. Bye.
Thank you, Ted.
All right. Thank you. And the, we're talking about guns. Not every kind of a deadly force would be guns. I mean, it could be baseball bats. It could be knives.
Yeah.
Probably a vehicle if you had to. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. But. Well, yeah. In one of the cases that I dealt with this summer, it dealt with a motor vehicle. There was a motor vehicle involved. And my client had a gun, and he felt threatened by a motor vehicle that was coming towards him that he thought was going to run over him, and he used a gun in self defense.
The law also with these self defense, with these self defense cases, it doesn't only apply to me. As defending myself, you can defend others. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. And defense of others has always been in the law to some degree for self-defense, but apply to others. And you have stand your ground protection with respect to defending others as well.
And, of course, in front of your family members, you can defend you. You can use it in defense of your family members. You can use it, if I'm not correct, in preventing a sodomy, rape, kidnapping. Is that correct?
Yes.
And are there some other offenses that they say that you can use it to prevent?
Sure. In Section 5 here, it says that you can protect others who are in a dwelling, business property, occupied vehicle, or even a federally licensed nuclear power facility. If someone is attempting to sabotage, you can protect them through the defense of others. Now, you've got to have the right to be there.
Yes.
We don't have vigilante justice where someone decides, I'm going to go be my own police force and go somewhere I don't have a right to be in the hopes of stopping something from going on. We have police and sheriff's deputies to do that. But if you have a right to be there, and if you are not trespassing, and if you are not breaking the law, then you can defend others who are in this situation. Now, what's interesting, Melvin, is I did some research, and in April of this year, there was a bill introduced in the House of Representatives that extended stand your ground protection to churches specifically. And it said that you could have this same protection on the premises of a church under certain conditions when the force is to commit physical injury, robbery or murder within a church. And that's something that hits home this week. And certainly we all pray, for the victims in Texas. This bill passed the House. It died in the Senate at the end of the session. I would expect, based on recent events, it'll be reintroduced. But arguably, that right already existed under the Defense of Others law that we already had.
Yes.
Because if someone is in a church legally, lawfully, they can defend themselves or others. I would think that the law we already have extends to that, but this bill it passed by a 2-1 margin in the Alabama House of Representatives.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And this was an Alabama law; it's not a United States law.
Not a United States law. Yes.
I wonder. There's probably not. Is there? I wonder if there is an equivalent in the United States in the district courts in the criminal law of the United States. I would think there probably some sort. But I don't know how.
I don't think there is a specific stand your ground law on the federal level, but certainly
it would be reserved to the states. I guess
it'd be reserved to the states, but the but certainly self defense would be an available defense in federal prosecutions as well. Of course, then you know in some federal cases you could get into a conflict of laws issue where you have a federal court applying state law, and so. That can lead to some interesting legal decisions there.
You know, the something else, when I look at the definitions of the new law, which is what we have to do when we're doing these cases, it is very important. They define what a building is,
mm-hmm.
They define what a dwelling is, and they define what a residence is. So in all these self-defense, anything that, you know, stand your ground or whatever else, they're going to talk about either using physical force or if you're justified in using deadly physical force, can you actually pull a gun on someone and shoot them? And it's interesting. I don't know where the residence, I don't know which one of these residents come in there, but a residence is defined as a dwelling in which a person resides either temporarily or permanently, or is visiting as an invited guest.
Yes, so it doesn't have to be your house.
Exactly. There it goes back to when we're talking about unlawful, are you lawfully there? You know, if I'm breaking into someone else's house, of course, then I probably can't use self-defense.
You can't use stand your ground.
Stand your ground.
There was a case in Morgan County that I heard about a few months ago where a defendant was charged with murder and he used a gun and he said self-defense and he also asserted stand your ground. The problem he had was he was a convicted felon himself. He had no right to even possess the handgun that he used against the victim, which he says was in self-defense. And so the judge, I believe, correctly overruled his stand your ground defense because he had no right to have that gun. The self-defense issue was allowed to go to the jury for the jury to decide, and the jury found him guilty. But so that's an important distinction, is that, you know, even if you don't qualify for immunity, you still may have self-defense, you know, as an available remedy.
Yes. Yes. You know, and we have, I haven't tried any, but we have seen these, actually the murder trial did was kind of like this. We see a lot of these self-defense stuff comes in when there's a drug deal gone bad.
Sure.
You know, somebody goes in someone's house and there's money owed, then there's knives pulled, and then there's guns pulled out, and people get shot. And I tell my clients, you know, when I'm trying to counsel my clients, as we normally, as we do a lot, try to hopefully get something across to them, I ask them, I was like, what are you going to do when you're in someone's house and they pull a knife or gun on you? I said, you're in a dilemma at that point because you're there committing a crime, buying dope, whatever you're doing, selling dope, whatever. But now you're faced with a life or death situation. Mm-hmm. So you're going to shoot and kill that person, and then you're going to be charged with murder. So if I was you, I would think about what you're doing, why you're doing it, and is it worth it?
Right.
You know, and it happens. There's no doubt there are people that's probably in prison charged with murder because they went into a house and guess what? The other person was there and they wasn't expecting that it's going to get their money back, their dope back, or whatever else. Somebody pulls a gun and it's all over with. Then it's you're charged. And how are you going to justify that?
So many crimes happen because someone is somewhere they shouldn't have been.
Yes.
And, you know, when you put yourself in that position and you're faced with that homeowner who's got the right to protect himself and his family and his property, there's not much defense if you're the intruder.
And the I was kind of looking, this is going back to the definitions, how they apply to these different cases. A building is defined as any structure which may be utilized by a person for business, mm-hmm. for public use,
mm-hmm.
for lodging, the storage of goods, so a storage building, a shed, whatever else, and includes any vehicle, aircraft, or watercraft used for the lodging of persons or carrying on business therein. So they mm-hmm. really go into depth about defining what a building is. And then a dwelling is a building which is usually occupied by a person lodging therein at night, or a building of any kind, including a balcony. So it's not just inside. They're actually smart enough to put any attached balcony, I guess that include a porch or whatever else, whether the building is temporary or permanent, is mobile or immobile, which has a roof over it. And it's designed to be occupied by people lodging therein at night.
Right. So a dwelling and a residence are not the same thing.
Exactly.
You could be staying
in a hotel.
At a hotel, and that's a dwelling for stand your ground purposes.
And I guess this would include, maybe you've done enough research on this, I guess this would include, let's talk about the defense of property. What is your understanding and what kind of force you can use in defense of property? Because it would be, it's probably a little bit different than defending a person's from rape, murder, or whatever else.
Yeah, well, it's the statute talks about defending against someone committing or about to commit burglary in any degree. You know, that there's different degrees of burglary. Third degree burglary is you know,
an unoccupied dwelling,
unoccupied structure, lawfully entering or remaining with the intention of committing a crime therein.
Yes.
It used to be committing a felony therein.
Yes.
Now it's committing a crime therein. And so, you know, under this law, you can stand your ground in defending that property against someone committing burglary in any degree.
Yes.
And because the legislature saw fit to determine burglary, at least in the stand your ground context, as a violent crime. And it makes sense because if someone is burglarizing your house, going to take your stuff, then most of the time,
yes,
they've got a weapon.
Yes.
Because under the same scenario you mentioned, Melvin, they don't want to be there when that homeowner gets there.
Yes.
And you know, they're going to want to get out. And so you've got the right to stand your ground if there is a burglary going on. You know, robbery in any degree. You know, burglary and robbery are different things, but you know, this shows it really shows that the legislature respects
people's
property rights.
Yes. You know, and I always like, I tell my defendants, because some people just think, well, it's burglary, it's not really that bad, but I have to remind people that are charged with it and people that pretty well are guilty of it, that commit burglary, you're actually committing two crimes. You are trespassing somebody's property, and you're trespassing to commit another crime.
To commit another crime.
You know, so I have to remind them, I said, look, you're actually committing two crimes, you know, and like robbery, you're committing two crimes. You're stealing something, plus you're using some kind of force to do it, you know, or threat of force something common. I guess you've probably handled it because one of my first robbery actually was a robbery second. I thought, oh my gosh, how can you get robbery second out of shoplifting? But people would be surprised how many people are charged with robbery second, have absolutely no weapons. Two people go into a Dollar General, and I don't know why they pick Dollar General, but they go into a Dollar General and they'll steal stuff, and one will walk out and then one of them ends up getting caught. They push the attendant there, tries to stop them. They push them away, simply push them away to escape. And
robbery.
The next thing, they are robbery second.
Yes.
2 to 20 years if you don't have any priors you're looking at. And I actually known people that were charged with robbery second that stole less than $5 worth of stuff from Dollar General.
Mm-hmm.
And they go to prison for that. And it is a violent crime. If robbery, you can't even get on community corrections. Is that correct? I think it's probably one of the cases. It's probably listed as a violent crime. You're not even eligible for community corrections.
It's a violent crime. You're not eligible for that. Violent offenders are treated differently than nonviolent offenders under our correction system.
They go to different prisons, spend longer amount of time.
That they're not eligible for some of the early release like some of the nonviolent offenders are. The scenario you mentioned, Melvin, reminds me of one of the things that happened with our habitual offender laws back in the 1980s, there was this department store over in Gadsden called Kitchens Department Store, and there were two guys who went in to steal some blue jeans from Kitchens Department Store. One of them happened to have two prior felonies. And the three strikes you're out habitual offender law was on the books that said on your third felony, you get life in prison. Well, so these guys get their pants and they're walking out and they get past the cash register. One of them gets away. The one who had two prior felonies doesn't even get out the door. The manager stops him and he says, well, hey, I didn't want these anyway.
Yes.
And hands them back. Well, at the time, felony theft was for anything over $25. It's
yes.
Now much higher, but at the time it was $25. And these jeans were priced at like $28.99. And he was sentenced to life in prison. And the judge had no discretion at all because that's what the law said. And the defendant said, well, it's not fair. I shouldn't do life in prison just for stealing this, and I didn't even get out the door. Well, the legislature passes all of these laws for a reason, and that's the system we live in. And people who may commit crimes, should think about those consequences.
They didn't intend on committing that crime. I wonder how many these capital murder defendants, if you really ask them, I think every one of them would tell you, I didn't intend on doing what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to rob the store.
Right.
I needed this. I was on drugs. I made a bad decision. I didn't mean to kill. I wasn't going to kill. Mm-hmm. But they put themselves in that situation, and it is a life-changing decision. You either spend the rest of your life in prison or a significant portion of it, or you get executed, not electrocuted anymore, get executed.
Absolutely. And then, so many of those cases, you've got drug issues involved, some sort of dependency, and like we said earlier, people being somewhere they shouldn't have been, in a position they never should have been in, maybe a place they never thought they would be in, but they were there.
Yes. And you really can't you can't say, hey, I'll have a jury that will feel sympathetic for me, because most of the people that's sitting on a jury, well, all of them really should be sitting on a jury, has not ever committed a crime. They're probably not drug addicts. They're probably most working class folks who go to work every day. And they're going to hear this story about decisions that you make, and they're probably not going to be too sympathetic on the fact that you was on drugs.
Right. Right. And
they're going to say, that's a decision you made. I get up every morning and go to work and don't do drugs. You get up, do drugs, go rob and kill people. They're not going to be very sympathetic. And that's right. The way they look at things.
Right. And in criminal cases, yes, the burden of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt is the highest burden in the law. But any doubt a jury has to be a reasonable doubt. It can't be a guess. It can't be something there's no basis for. It's got to be a reasonable doubt. And prosecutors and defense attorneys will argue different versions of this. You know, typically a prosecutor will argue his case. Good prosecutors do that. You know, that any doubt that's there is not reasonable.
Yes.
And typically, defense lawyers will argue that all doubts are reasonable.
Yes.
And that the defendant should therefore be acquitted.
And your pattern jury instructions, the instructions that's given to a jury about reasonable doubt, tells you what it is not. It never tells you what it is.
Right.
It is stacked against you, even though the burden's out there and the TV shows probably help out some, but the instructions not very helpful to most defendants.
No, it says it is not a vague doubt.
A conjecture.
I think we probably both got it memorized yes. by now.
Well, Mr. Champ, this has been interesting. This is not a topic that we have discussed. I was glad that you brought it up, because I've been doing this for a few months, our little radio show, and we try to bring up topics that are interesting and that's not that people have questions about. This is one, for whatever reason, I've just never really thought about it. And I haven't had the opportunity to use this in a trial yet. I don't know if I have a case now that I have one. But this is interesting. I'm glad that you came and used your experience in this. And letting us know about it.
Well, I appreciate it, Melvin. I've enjoyed being here, and every time I do these shows, they just fly by.
They do.
Really enjoyed it, and I appreciate the opportunity.
All right, thank you very much. And y'all, we're cutting it short tonight. I've got to be somewhere, but we appreciate you. Appreciate Mr. Big D, and hope you get to feeling better letting us do this. Appreciate the radio station, and tune back in next week. Hopefully we'll have another guest. We're going to have Champ back up here sometime and find us another topic to talk about. All right. Thank you very much.
Hey guys, let's face it, we all want to look our best, but with minimal effort, right? Well, that's where Angela at Scissor Salon comes in. She'll get you looking your best, so you're always on top of your game. Walk-ins are always welcome. Scissor Salon, Highway 278 East, just past the water plant, 735-3089, 735-3089. Look for the big scissors on the roof. Friday Night Live kicks off the Alabama High School State Playoffs this Thursday night.
Nick Phillips on the carry, big hole, 40, 35, 30, 20, running away from Warriors.
The Holly Pond Broncos travel to West Morgan to take on the Rebels. Hear all the action right here on Live 95 this Thursday night beginning at 6:45. Or listen anywhere in the world via the TuneIn Radio app. Just search Live 95 Coleman or stream at Live95Coleman.com. The high school state playoffs on Friday Night Live. This Thursday night, as Holly Pond travels to West Morgan on Friday Night Live, here on Live 95, Coleman's independent radio.
Are you having trouble seeing your computer screen? Are the traffic signs looking a little fuzzy? Are the things that you used to be able to see looking just a little out of focus? Dr. Wayne Fuller has been helping Coleman see better for years, and he's still located on 2nd Avenue between the Catholic Church and Highway 278. You can call his friendly staff at 256-734-1121, and they'll be happy to get you seeing better, whether it's with contacts, glasses designed just for you, or a low-cost alternative to LASIK. Again, Dr. Wayne Fuller is available at 256-734-1121.